Yeah, I think that what you said earlier about your investment in NewsGator, you said you found that 100x entrepreneur, and 100x people, basically a big idea and a 100x person that makes a company. The 100x people are so hard to find, and they make all the difference in the world, in any industry, in anything in life. And the dichotomy here is the 100x person can happen anywhere, and but you need density around that person to be successful. Like you said, you need other people. And one of the reasons why Silicon Valley is so great is it has the density and the ecosystem and all the other support services to make a company succeed. It has the recruiting capability, and you can bring in the VP of engineering, and you can bring in people who have done it before, and you can really fill out a company. That's great about density. But if a 100x person is sitting in Beijing and doesn't have all that around them, but that 100x person is so valuable, you want to build something around them. And there's just a very tough tension between that. But 20 years ago, if there was a 100x person in Beijing, they would never get heard from. That person had no chance. You know, again, Thomas Friedman in The World is Flat says, 20 years ago, if you had a choice of being a genius in Beijing or a B student in Poughkeepsie, you would choose the B student in Poughkeepsie because you'd have a better chance at a life. But fast forward to today, that's exactly the opposite. If you're a genius in Shanghai, you have a chance today because you can touch the whole planet. And hopefully, you can get the resources organized around you to be successful and get the ecosystem you need. And what you're saying is, we need capital to find that guy. And one of the things that venture capital is so good at is finding those 100x people, you know, knowing what they look like, what they talk like, what they smell like, and identifying that person amongst a billion people, say, in China.
How does the genius in Poughkeepsie do now?
Oh, yeah.
let me try and bring this back around now. Tim had brought up, we've brought up Skype a couple of times here, and I think one of the things we're getting at is that company can get funded anywhere and that VCs are willing to back that and the like. But I think one of the things that you look at, and I'll pull out three companies as being real successful examples of this, Skype, Google, and MySpace, were all companies that a number of venture capitalists had a chance to back at various points in time. The Skype example, basically 3/4, I think, of the European venture capital community passed on it. Google's one of those legendary ones. And then MySpace was one that we've had a few panels where VCs have said, I just didn't get it. I'm wondering, again, coming back to that sort of risk, and we're talking about getting into new areas and the like, what is it that makes a VC comfortable? What, with the Skype example, for instance, what made you decide, yeah, we can take a gamble on these guys who were basically running from the music industry over in Europe? And what is it that's going to make the VCs do those kind of deals?
You know, it's interesting. If every one of my partners votes for something, it always loses all the money. and I've tried to analyze this, this is all I can come up with. What I can come up with is, if it's that obvious, it's too late. If it's that obvious, everybody knows about it. There's nothing here. There's nothing special. And this entrepreneur is going to be fighting a tough battle. On the other hand, if one of us, or maybe two of us, like it, and everybody else is emotionally heavily against it, it ends up being a big win. So in a democratic partnership, what do you do? We've created a very interesting and proprietary voting system. And I think it kind of works. But I don't know if there's any other way to describe it. Now, the other thing is, if you're going after something and you're going after it in just a heavy-handed, you know, we're going to go after this market kind of way, you tend not to have a big win there. If you come at something in an interesting kind of roundabout way, like the entrepreneur was working on moldy bread and he found penicillin, that tends to be a better outcome. If you end up because Skype actually started with an entirely different business model, which they are going to pursue now. But But then they came up with this, well, you know, I guess we could do free voice. And that was, you know, that was sort of the, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. And kind of interesting is all you get if it's going to be that big a win. It's never that interesting, and it's always, I think it's always going to be controversial in a partnership.
Scott, do you guys have a proprietary voting system as well? Or?
Well, we're an expansion stage firm, so we have the benefit of coming in after Tim and our peers up here have done all the hard work. So we get to look at the traction of the company. So we're really operating at a different end of the scale.
Is there anything that you've seen? I mean, you mentioned like Alibaba as being one that I mean, that sounds like, in theory, doing an eBay somewhere else would sort of make sense, but you also mentioned about you're going up against eBay, basically.
Right. Well, Alibaba had a very different business model. They started off with, it was a B2B play in China, and B2B never really worked here. They actually figured out how to monetize it in China. It's another one of these deals that a lot of people looked at, and we looked at it a couple of times and kept coming back to it, but we passed. And the whole thing was China's opening up, but there's no infrastructure for people to exchange goods in China. There's no white pages, no yellow pages. There's no credit ratings. There's no way to evaluate a buyer in Tibet and somebody in Shenzhen trying to figure out who is that person, can I trust them? So they needed an infrastructure to do it, and that's what Alibaba initially started doing. They morphed. They created a second business, which was the auction. One of the things we found in China, though, and we've missed a few awesome winners, was applying standard conventional U.S. thinking. So there was this company that went public last year called Focus Media in China. It's a billion-dollar outcome. We passed on it. And what they...
Of course.
Yeah, it's a great... Tim has more vision than everybody in this room, you know, put together. But we looked at it and said, okay, so they have all these elevators, and basically what it is, the business model, flat panels and elevators, and they sell advertising. And it didn't work in the U.S., and we said, it's not going to work here, but it was a great insight. And so what we have found is sometimes you have to suspend disbelief as well and say, what if?
Bill, you've created a number of companies over the years. You were early in the search area. What is it that you've seen from the venture capitalists that will make them take a bet, I guess that's a safe word, on an early stage opportunity?
Well, I really love Tim's story about the controversialness of the idea and the partnership not necessarily agreeing on it. Right in our mission statement is challenge the status quo. We want to start companies that challenge the status quo because that's how we think we can change the world. But by definition, when you're trying that, you're going to be looked at as crazy sometimes. And one company that we did together, we had the idea for a go-to for paid search. And it was a crazy idea. People really did not like that. There were people who were angry about that idea at that time. And I remember Tim came to our office vividly, and I showed it to him, and he said, that is a great idea. And just immediately, he latched on to the challenging nature of it. And we might not have succeeded. That didn't mean it was guaranteed to succeed, but it had some attributes that were quite good. When you do something that challenging, a lot of people think it's a dumb idea for a while, and it gives you a little bit more time with no competition because people aren't trying to copy you when they don't think it's a good idea. And if it really is a good idea, which remains to be seen, you have to prove it out, then you get quite a good lead, and it really did work out quite well. But we love to try and do things like that. They don't always work. Another one we tried was Free PC, and it was just a few 2 years ahead of its time. Today, that would work great. With the AdSense and ad networks now, you could make that work, but we couldn't make that work back in 2000.
I think there's an important insight, and I think, Scott, you sort of signaled it. You have to segment between sort of expansion stage or later stage and early stage. And if you take the expansion stage out and you focus on early stage, the experience I've had, you know, with hundreds and hundreds of companies that we funded, and then also looking at all the ones we didn't fund, is that institutionalizing the decision-making process for early stage investment is just fucking stupid, right? It's the everything that we wanted to do as a democracy failed, and everything that somebody was passionately engaged in, not everything, but the ones that really succeeded, somebody was passionately engaged in. And the challenge, I think, of early stage venture capital is that as firms raise money and as you add more partners and as you have more history And as you try to do more things, you start to institutionalize what previously, and institutionalize across a firm, what previously was an individually focused endeavor. And really, the genius, if you look at so many of these companies, and even the ones that you had an example, there was a partner who said, I want to do this. I mean, I don't care, you know, you guys don't like it. I want to do this. And that those were the things that had extreme vectors of success versus the ones where everybody says, yeah. Enterprise, this, yeah, there's a market for that. It's been validated. It just doesn't turn anything. So, you know, the cliche that I heard a lot when I started doing this a decade ago was, you know, go where everybody else isn't. And the problem is that doesn't really work either. Because, you know, usually there's a reason why people aren't somewhere, and unless you have the ability to think in front of where it's going to be, going there doesn't help you that much. So it's the dynamic of trying to get away from the institutionalization of the early stage decision making, which is why you've seen some massively successful angel investors, people that, you know, I'm just going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do that, because they didn't try to create something that, you know, had a voting process where everybody had to score an 8 on the vote, or higher, or else it didn't get done.
Let's turn to some of the areas that we're sort of talking about as being somewhat new, although many of them have gotten so much money now that you probably wouldn't even consider it, but blogging and podcasting, we're going to have a section on that in a little bit here. You've taken an interest, at least, in being a blogger from a VC perspective. What's your view of the investment area itself?
You know, the second that everybody starts talking about it, it's time to think about the next thing. So I would say that the...
So what's the next thing, then?
Well, I'm not going to say that. the dynamic, interestingly, is that both on the content and the infrastructure side, there's now been so much venture investment. You know, you're starting to see in any infrastructure segment around blogging, podcasting, RSS, Adam, syndication, feeds, whatever you want to call it, you're now seeing the third, fourth, fifth, you know, in some case, nth deal being funded. Okay, that segment is fully funded out. Many of the things that are getting funded now are such incremental features and such narrow gauge features that they're just not that interesting. The content side is still actually quite vibrant, because I don't think people really understand, especially the sort of traditional venture industry, understands how the media dynamic works. And MySpace is a good example of that. You don't catch sort of what the threads of real adoption are. So there's probably lots of opportunities there. And what's happened is the shift from, if you looked at initially blogging, which was text, and then looked at podcasting, which was audio, and then looked at video, you know, we're clearly on the wave now where a number of the video bets have been placed in terms of infrastructure. So you know, the dynamic of trying to figure out how those things fit together and link together in a more significant way starts to be interesting. But I think from a raw, is there room in the world to make another blogging-related investment? If somebody came and was talking about that, you'd sort of scratch your head. What are you talking about?
Is there going to be a big winner out of that?
Hope so.
Has that company been funded, you think?
There's a couple of companies that if you look at the world as having the world that blogging and podcasting and all this addresses is having two constituencies, there's some very interesting companies. So one constituency is the subscriber or the people that are consuming information, and the other constituency is the publisher, the person creating information. And, of course, the phenomena here is that you don't have big companies as publishers, but you can, and you don't have big companies as consumers, but you can. Right, so the blogging phenomena started off as small publisher to small subscriber and rapidly has grown to many to many, where it's all different categories of subscribers and all different categories of publishers. The companies that can take advantage of a geometric effect where the growth of subscribers and the growth of publishers impact their business in a way that causes them to have a geometric outcome creates a big winner. We have a company, FeedBurner, together with Draper Fisher that we've been involved in. That's a great example of exactly that, which is every day we wake up, and if you look at the statistics, they have more publishers in their network every day, and each of the publishers in their network has more subscribers every day. And what that's generating is more ad inventory for them to go sell, which is the core business model. And, you know, it's geometric. So, you know, you're looking for things like that. But, yeah, no, I mean, you know, I would expect that there will be some significant winners on the infrastructure side. And the content side's a little harder to tell, because I don't think people can easily point at, you know, here are companies that have really captured how people are going to use and consume this content and therefore generate. You know, the blogging network phenomena is one that clearly looks more like an angel-funded theme than a venture-funded theme, where the exits are, you know, $10, $20, $30 million type exits by the time the properties reach some scale. But we'll see.